Hi, folks. I'm Dakota Cohen. Thank you so much for checking out the Building Your Homestead podcast, where I talk with expert guests about agriculture, health, economics, technology, philosophy, and other topics that I believe will help us to peacefully exit the increasing tyranny of our world and start building a parallel system, one homestead at a time. Robert, thanks so much for coming on the podcast.
Hey, man. Thanks for having me. Glad to be here.
Okay, so to kick it off, I've heard you say many times that the question, what is money, is the most important question in the world. What was the event or series of events that led you to that insight?
Well, I've always been a curious kid and started reading a lot at a very young age at the behest of my mother, who I think was tired of answering all the questions I was bombarding her with. And my curiosity initially, it took me a lot of places. When I was really young, I was curious about the cosmos and nature. I read a lot about physics and astrophysics and astronomy and things of that sort. A little bit later, I got really interested into philosophy, mainly Eastern philosophy. And then as I got into late high school, early college years, I was very interested in markets, economics. And in trying to understand economics, which really I was just mystified by the stock market initially. I could not understand what all the uproar was about. Like, people are trading these paper certificates. I didn't really understand what it meant, yet somehow it made the world go round. So in trying to get my head around that, I started reading The Economist magazine initially, which I would not recommend. The writing is really good, but it's, in retrospect, it's a lot of Keynesian pseudoscience. I started to read some economics newsletters. And from one of these newsletters, I picked up a book recommendation for a book titled The Creature from Jekyll Island. And The Creature from Jekyll Island is a book about the inception of the Federal Reserve, which is the central bank in the United States. It's about a history of central banking more broadly as well. And then it also goes into the nature of money itself. And that book, I think I read when I was like 19, 20 years old, brought me to the conclusion that broken money is the source of most problems in the world today. And at the time, again, this is probably 2004, 2005 timeframe, there was not really a solution to central banking. And I just sort of put it on a shelf. You know, I just said, hey, you know, this is the problem in the world from my perspective. If we could fix one thing in the world, it would be to fix the money, because so many things in human experience are downstream from the money. Like, if the money doesn't work, then human society basically does not work. And to get a very clear picture of this, you could just look at conditions in any the conditions that pervade under any hyperinflationary regime, right? Anywhere the currency has collapsed and failed, you can see what people are doing. And they're basically living hand to mouth. You know, trust collapses, division of labor collapses, there's no wealth being produced, production processes collapse, you know, people are eating their pets, paper cash is clogging the gutters. It's just terrible. It's as terrible of anything as you can possibly imagine. And so that book sort of set the stage for me that money is really the core problem in the world today, but there was no solution. And then several years later, it's 2016, 2017, I discovered Bitcoin. Initially was interested in crypto, and eventually just bit by process of studying came to see that Bitcoin's the only crypto asset that matters. That's something we can talk about later. And that was the aha moment for me when I saw that Bitcoin is the solution to the problem that central banking posed to the world. That was the big light bulb for me. And I think that's why Bitcoiners are so adamant today when they say, you know, fix the money, fix the world, that it really is it's kind of this problem that's hidden in plain sight. You know, we know the value of free markets. We know the value of distributed problem solving. We know the value of innovation. Yet we have stifled all of those things in the sphere of money, you know, in the name of monetary central planning, which is central banking. And in a way, I just think humans have not been able to get out of their own way prior to the invention of Bitcoin, because the temptation to control money and manipulate it for one's own benefit at the expense of others is just, the temptation is too great for human beings to resist. So that's it, you know. And then much more recently, November 2020, I launched the podcast, The What Is Money Show, and we explore this idea in depth. People often ask me, is it a finance podcast? And my answer is no. It's anything but that, actually. We talk about, you know, technology, physics, philosophy, history, even metaphysics at times, how the human enterprise has been changed through technology, through ideas. We talk about the nature of language, because there's many parallels between language and money. And it's a very cerebral kind of podcast. And the central point of inquiry is, what is money? And there are many, many answers to that question. It's kind of like asking one of these profound questions. What is truth? What is beauty? What is justice? And it's been a hell of a journey. I get to talk to a lot of intelligent people, getting a lot of different perspectives on the nature of money, and hopefully learning in the process, and learning in a way that my audience can come along for the ride.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's a fantastic podcast. And, you know, the link for that's going to be in the show notes. Robert, when you're, you know, talking to, you know, a layman, or you're, you know, chatting about what is money more casually with someone, is there like a particular fact, or is there like, what's the most disturbing thing that you've learned about how our current financial system works that was just, you know, shocking to you, or particularly effective at helping people to realize that, like, we need to address this problem of what is money?
Well, one that jumps out to me as you're asking the question is just how often people mistake money for actual wealth. You know, everyone thinks they want more dollars, but you don't actually want more dollars. You want the things that dollars can buy you. And so economists call this purchasing power, right? This is the amount of purchasing that the money enables you to perform, right? How many cars or houses or pounds of beef can that money buy you? That is the purchasing power contained within the money. And so, you know, $1 million used to be a lot of money. Used to really be a milestone for a lot of people to become a millionaire.
Yeah.
Well, the price of beef has tripled in the past 3 years in the United States. So if you had $1 million 3 years ago, the purchasing power in terms of $1 million has gone down by 67% in the past 3 years.
Mm-hmm.
So you could still have $1 million today, but that $1 million will only buy you 1/3 of the beef that it used to buy you. And so I call this it's kind of like a cognitive optical illusion, where people are so focused on the dollar, you know, getting more dollars in their bank account, in their brokerage statement, the nominal value of their assets, whether it's their house or art they might collect, you know, as long as the dollar value is going up, the nominal value, the notional value, they think things are okay. They think they're richer. They think they're better off. But this is an illusion, right? It's an illusion, because it belies the truth that although the number of dollars in your accounts may be increasing, the purchasing power of each dollar is simultaneously decreasing. So it masks this transference of real wealth from those saving in dollars or dollar denominated assets to those who print new dollars, which are the shareholders of central banks and those that are politically connected or favored enough to get access to the newly printed money first. For people that are interested in that phenomenon, they could Google the Cantillon effect, which was named after Richard Cantillon. Basically says, it's pretty obvious, when you print new money, those who get the newly printed money first and can spend it when it's at its maximal value before it enters wider circulation and becomes depreciated, benefit at the expense of those who receive the newly printed money later. Hayek analogized this to pouring honey in a jar, right? Like the honey sort of piles up in the middle at first. It's very viscous, and then it slowly widens out. So that purchasing power of newly printed money is still high, but then as it enters broader circulation, the money, you know, there's more dollars chasing the same amount of goods and services. Therefore, the price of goods and services goes up. So if you were just holding dollars the whole time or living on fixed income, living paycheck to paycheck, et cetera, you're basically getting taxed or robbed by those who are getting the newly printed money first. So this is the big one, right? Like people are just duped by thinking getting more dollars is good. And it's simply not enough. It's not enough.
Yeah.
And Alan Watts has a great quote on this. This is where, you know, there is a relation between money and language, because the words we use to relate to things are not the things themselves, right? Obviously, we need language to communicate about the world, but what did the ancient Taoists say? The finger that points at the moon is not the moon, right? Words are basically pointers to things or ideas or concepts. They're not the thing or the idea or the concept themselves. Alan Watts said, What we have forgotten is that thoughts and words are conventions, and that it is fatal to take conventions too seriously. A convention is a social convenience, as, for example, money. But it is absurd to take money too seriously, to confuse it with real wealth. In somewhat the same way, thoughts, ideas, and words are quote-unquote coins for real things. So we are animals that use language, right? Where, as Aristotle said, we're the rational animal, and language is among our most important tools. And my argument, or a strong argument that's shared on the show, is that money is equally as important as language, if not more important. I actually think it predates language, but has many of these linguistic qualities that human civilization simply cannot function without.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, my brother used to work in Cuba, and he said that on payday, every store, was the shelves were empty. Yeah. As soon as payday hit, because people would rush into town and buy whatever they could, because they knew that the purchasing power of their money, because every round of paychecks, you know, was being, as you said, diluted by more printed money. They knew that on the next Monday, they'd be able to buy less of the rice or the toothpaste or the, you know, the meat or the salt that they could have bought on the Friday.
And it's in Weimar Germany, when the Reichmark was hyperinflating, people would go to the bar on payday, and they would buy all the beer they were going to drink for the night at the beginning of the night. Because the prices literally changed every few hours.
Oh, wow.
So prices on beer would go up every few hours. So this that same phenomenon, it holds at different durations, right? As the currency is depreciating more quickly, prices change more quickly, and people become that much more desperate to spend the dollars before they depreciate.
Yeah, exactly. And so, like, you know, can you walk people through, like, what would the current inflation rate be in, like, maybe the official and the unofficial inflation rate in, say, you know, the United States or Canada or kind of most first world countries right now?
Yeah, it's really difficult, actually. And fundamentally, it's impossible to name an actual inflation rate. And the reason is because inflation is as subjective as the individual buyer, right? It's what things are you looking to buy? How quickly are their prices changing?
Uh-huh.
The basket of those goods and services that is unique to each buyer basically is your own inflation coefficient.
Yeah.
So now the government would have you believe, and Mises basically proved that in his book, Human Action. He said it's impossible to have a universal inflation metric for that very reason, right? It's as subjective as the process of valuation itself. And this is a key point in economics, that value is subjective. People might think even certain life essential things, right? Like water might be intrinsically valuable, but run away from anyone that uses the term intrinsic value. It's simply economic nonsense. And to prove the point, I would ask you, you know, how much value does water have to a drowning man? You know, even water, even air, like all, nothing, no matter how essential it is valuable to everyone in every situation. It's just not possible. Value is, it's in how we respond to the conditions of our environment. It's a matter of response, a matter of adaptation, and therefore it is subjective to each individual and their circumstances.
Mm-hmm.
What was the original question? I'm sorry, I deviated.
I wanted to dig into like the giving people some ideas of inflation rates. Cause I think, you know, when we talk about Weimar Republic and like, you know, the price of beer increasing every hour, people think, well, that can't happen here.
Yeah.
Cause we're comparing it to these extreme situations. But as you said at the beginning of the podcast, you know, the price of beef has tripled in the past 3 years.
Yeah. So exactly. So to have an inflation rate is actually not possible for the reasons just described.
Mm-hmm.
However, it's very convenient for a governmental body to prescribe an inflation rate or say that, you know, CPI, the Consumer Purchase Index, right? So this is a basket of goods and services that has been arbitrarily selected by the state. And they say these are the things that individuals need to buy to survive, right? It's X percent this, Y percent that. And so long as they manage the price changes in that government selected basket of goods, then they are determining what is good or bad inflation.
Yeah.
Now, there's a number of problems with this. First of all, again, it's not possible initially. But second of all, they are selecting what goes in and out of that basket of goods. And amazingly, that basket excludes volatile items such as food and energy. Now, if you just pause on that for a second and think that the metric intended to evaluate price volatility excludes, the calculation of that metric excludes volatile items, you can see how much of a scam this is, right?
Yeah.
They're just basically handpicking whatever they want that's not changing in price or is going down in price so they can get to this target 2% inflation number, which is just total utter nonsense, basically.
Yeah.
So so you can't really ask what is the real inflation rate. The best proxy for this is just going to be the actual change in the money supply year over year.
Yeah.
Because this is the amount of currency that's being counterfeited. Now it's being legally counterfeited, but counterfeited nonetheless. There's no economic distinction between you or I trying to counterfeit a US $100 bill. There's no economic distinction between that activity and what the Federal Reserve engages in, called quantitative easing, right? Where the government creates new debt out of thin air, and the central bank buys this new debt with newly printed dollars. So then the central bank and its shareholders are now being paid interest on newly paid dollars, on money they just created out of thin air. And now when money is created out of thin air, I would argue this is not technically money, it's currency. They're creating new units of currency out of thin air. That is, and as that currency enters wider circulation, everyone that's holding dollars in an account, these are dollar savers, they are being extorted effectively by those that are creating the new units of currency. So this is the asymmetric system that we live in, right? There's one group of people that can print new units of currency, small fraction of people. There's a vast group of people that are forced to use that currency, literally via legal tender laws, right? You have to pay your taxes in dollars. You must use it in settlement of all debts, public and private, or face legal ramifications, basically. So the rate at which the currency is counterfeited is the closest proxy you're going to get to inflation. And we have increased, I would specifically say it's M2. And again, these are still numbers coming out of the Federal Reserve, so they're not as reliable as you would like them to be. Ideally, you would have a universally transparent and auditable money that we could all know what the supply is at any given time. We would know what the supply is going to be. We would know what rules are being used to decide. We would be free to switch out of the monetary system if it didn't suit our interests. So we could fork the system anytime we want. Yeah. Obviously, I'm alluding to Bitcoin here and its value in comparison to fiat. But over the past, since 2020, we have increased USM2 over 40%. So we mentioned the price of beef has tripled. Well, the general price level has roughly gone up 40%. Now, you've seen this. It's disproportionate, right? Like, assets have gone up more quickly than consumables, for instance, because what do people do in an inflationary environment? Well, the natural thing is to not save in the currency that's being counterfeited and instead save in something that cannot be counterfeited, like commodities, real estate, equities, anything that can't be arbitrarily printed. And that's indeed what people do. There's also another effect too. You see global debt exploding relative to GDP. And this is because of the incentives associated with depreciating currency. We are all incentivized to borrow dollars today when they're stronger, spend them to acquire things, and then pay back that debt over a term during which those dollars become weaker, right? Through inflation, right? So you're borrowing stronger dollars and paying back weaker dollars. This is why debt explodes when you depreciate currency in this way. So, I mean, I think those are just some good things to think about. It's we've inverted the entire idea of economics, which is, you know, produce and save and then consume. The whole Keynesian economic model is literally flips it on its head. It's, if there's an economic crisis, well, then pump more liquidity in the system, get people to consume more, which will get producers to produce more, and savings be damned, basically.
Yeah.
And so we end up with this totally debt-ridden, fragilized world. And there's also, it also drives the gap between rich and poor more and more. So we're literally destroying the world through money printing.
Yeah, absolutely. And it, you know, like you said, it's really insidious how well it works. Like I've had many conversations with people who are aware of, you know, the government corruption and, you know, all these other things that are wrong with the world. But at the same time, those same people are clamoring for, you know, things like universal basic income or subsidies, government subsidies for their particular industry or, you know, various welfare programs.
Yeah.
Like that's all just the same process of inflation.
That's right.
And I saw a great meme the other day, which was, you know, the value of your house hasn't gone up. The purchasing power of your dollars has been going down.
Exactly.
Yeah.
That's the illusion. And that's, you know, the simplest lesson in the world, I think. I mean, if you could take away nothing else about money, it's just that. So when the nominal value of something goes up, does not mean the value, like the real value of the thing went up, right? Yeah. This is the same thing as if we redefine the actual spatial dimensions of an inch or a foot or a meter, right? If I just make that smaller, well, then all of a sudden the square feet of my house goes up.
Yeah.
In nominal terms, right? Yeah. If it's a 2,000 square foot house and I increase it, you know, or reduce the definition of it, what is it, by a third, then you can increase the size of your house by 50% nominal terms.
Yeah.
but your actual house hasn't changed. Of course, we've just changed what we call a square foot.
Yeah.
So it's the same thing, right? There's a specific supply of goods in the world. Mm-hmm. You can denominate that in $1, in $1 million, in $1 trillion. It doesn't matter. But change the problem is when one group can produce new units of that instrument that can be used to obtain the goods, and another group doesn't get access to that money until much later, that currency until much later. Then you get this asymmetric transfer of wealth, basically from the poor to the rich. This is the anti-Robin Hood, right? Yeah. This is stealing from the poor, giving to the rich. And that's why central banking is, in my estimation, inherently evil and inherently destructive to social cohesion and human economization.
Yeah. So taking this idea of inflation and the other problems of our current fiat money system, I've heard you say many times that, you know, when you corrupt money, it corrupts everything in the society. Can you talk about some of the kind of the snowballing effect or the moral ramifications of what happens when, you know, money printer goes burr?
Yeah. Well, I guess we mentioned this sort of earlier, but how people are always looking for another government handout, government subsidy. You know, there's a weird thing here because basically everyone is looking to gain something for nothing, as I often say on the show.
Mm-hmm.
And so you might be very favorable to a money printer if you're one of the insiders, right? It's a great business. You literally yeah. can't lose. You just, no matter what's happening in the economy, doesn't matter what conditions are, you're literally printing money. You never mm-hmm. take a loss. A central bank, if we could look at a central bank's actual profit and loss statement, these businesses are not audited. They do not disclose anything. They're private institutions. As we joke with the Federal Reserve, it's not federal and it has no reserves, right? It's as federal as Federal Express and it has no reserves. If you could see the P&L of these organizations, you would see a business that's profitable in perpetuity. You're literally printing money. Imagine if your business could print money. Would you ever incur a loss in your business if you could print money? Like, no, it's not possible. So long as there's enough idiots willing to accept your money, then you'll never incur a loss.
Yeah.
So there's basically this idea, you know, this idea at the heart of Western civilization. And this goes all the way back to the year 1215 when King John signed the Magna Carta. And the ideal was life, liberty, inviolable property, right? Property, like individuals able to own things that other individuals have no right to take. And that ideal of people being able to keep the things they earn, right, and be free to trade amongst themselves is what supports a free market, that a free market in which people can actually discover the best solutions, right? The fastest, cheapest, best ways to solve problems for one another. It's the way new innovations come to the fore, right? Someone figures out, hey, I can do, instead of using animals to move this plow, we can use a steam engine, right? And all of a sudden you can increase human productivity through technological advancement. And then those ideas spread around the world through imitation. This idea is what, this is what Mises said, that if history could teach us anything, it's that private property is inextricably linked to civilization. Like, we basically have one of two ways of resolving disputes over scarce resources, which is a fight we're always going to be in, right? We're mortal. We're finite in terms of time, in terms of ability, in terms of energy. We're living in a world that only offers us so much, right? There's competition over resources to survive. Well, we can either kill each other over every sandwich, or we can have private property and the rule of law, and we can resolve our disputes over every sandwich and everything else in a nonviolent, rational way. So if you, and this is just, I mean, this is just, this is it, right? You're not going to have civilization without private property. You could almost say the point of civilization is to enforce private property, right? That's what the rule of law is. Property is nine, you know, you often hear possession is 9/10 of the law, but if you really boil it down, private property is 10/10 of the law. There's no instance where the law does anything else other than enforce protection of you, your body and your property. And if we consider here that you own yourself, so basically your body is your property, right? That's an inalienable form of private property that only you control yourself, only you can own yourself. You can't even give away, can't give yourself away to someone, because you always, if you changed your mind, well, you still own yourself, right? Mm-hmm. So private property is very important. We talk about this a lot on the show. Printing money is only a violation of private property. It is nothing else. Now, it is sold to people as some type of remedy to economic issues due to that cognitive optical illusion I mentioned earlier, right? If you only think one order deep and you say, oh, we're in an economic recession, people are desperate for money, there's not enough money circulating, people aren't buying, you know, spending, investing enough, how do we solve this? Well, someone that, you know, is ignorant of economics and doesn't think more than one level deep might say, oh, let's just print new money. Let's just create some new money, right? And give it to the people that don't have money. And there you go. We don't have enough money. Let's print more money. Everyone has enough money. And we're off to the races again. But this, again, is just like saying, oh, my house isn't big enough. What are we going to do? Mm-hmm. Well, I got an idea. Let's redefine square foot. You know, let's just make it smaller and make the house bigger. And that'll be that. Why 2,000 square foot house is a 3,000 square foot house and everyone's happy. It's like you haven't changed anything in reality. Yeah. And this is basic. Just apply your intuition for 1 second. Uh-huh. Does anyone in the world actually believe that printing new units of paper can put food in people's mouths, can put roofs over people's head, can put cars in people's driveways? Like, no. All production requires work. You can't just magically press a button. You can't press print new dollars and cars or houses or food appears, obviously. Yet, again, we operate under this Keynesian illusion that that is possible. So private property being the central pillar to civilization itself and the printing of money being the most widespread way to violate private property, and in a way that lets the state deny it and blame it on others, right? I just saw, it is so clown world. I just saw this video of Joe Biden. This is a Super Bowl commercial.
Yeah, I saw it too.
And he's saying, you know what? Prices of snacks. We're like, if you're like me in the big game, you like to have a nice snack. But you might have noticed the prices of snacks have gone up the past few years. Especially ice cream. I love ice cream so much. And the price of ice cream has gone up, blah, blah, blah. And my administration is calling on all of these producers that are increasing their prices to stop. Stop this price increasing. It's like, are you fucking kidding me?
Yeah.
Are you really going to sit there and call out hardworking producers that compete amongst themselves to offer consumers the best possible satisfaction of consumer wants at the best possible prices, because they're competing with one another, right? They're always competing for market share. So they need to either deliver a product that's higher quality or deliver a product that's at a lower cost. That's how they attract market share. That is a like a self-regulating process that constantly pushes out new, better, and more products, right? That is fantastic. And by the way, prices would tend to go down in a free market, because as we get smarter, as we become more technologically sophisticated, as we accumulate more capital goods, which let us amplify the returns on human labor, then we can produce things faster, better, cheaper, right? So, and when you say produce things faster, better, cheaper, that's equivalent to saying price go down.
Yeah.
Right. This is the point of technology. This is the point of the free market. It's, you know, to make it very obvious, you're going to produce a lot more apples per man hour when you have an apple picking machine,
yeah,
rather than one guy out there picking apples by hand, right? So obviously the price per apple in terms of human time goes down when you have a machine that increases productivity, right? There's nothing about free market competition that increases prices. No. Like, of course, you have aberrations here and there, right? There might be a shortage. Maybe there was a drought and apples, you know, an apple crop failed. So the prices of apples went up for a season. But when the price of apples goes up for a season, again, the free market heals this wound naturally. Because when the prices of apples go up, you're doing two things. You're incentivizing producers, agriculturalists, to produce more apples because they sell at a higher price. Simultaneously, on the other side of the market, you're incentivizing consumers to eat less apples or eat something else, right? So this resolves the problem. It's a self-resolving thing. So for Joe Biden to come on TV and say, you know what, you producers, stop increasing your prices, yeah, and not mention one thing about the $8 trillion, U.S. dollars, that have been counterfeited over the past 4 years,
yeah,
is asinine. I mean, the tweet that I put out about this said that this is like mentioning, not mentioning lack of oxygen as a cause of death for a drowned man.
Yeah.
Like, when you're going to get on TV and talk about the problems of inflation, but not mention the counterfeiting of $8 trillion, you're not even stating the sole problem. It's the only problem that caused it. So the point of all this is, due to people's ignorance about money, about economics, about inflation, about private property, the government can get away with this shit. He runs a Super Bowl commercial. A Super Bowl commercial.
Yeah.
Blaming price increases on producers. And people are like, yeah, fuck those guys. Fuck those ice cream makers, those greedy capitalists.
Yeah.
It's incredible. And it's just because of this failure to understand the nature of money. So back to your much earlier question, why is this such an important question? I was like, well, if people had, in general, had like sort of answered that question for themselves, that would not work. Like, you couldn't run that commercial on TV, right? There'd be tomorrow, that'd be like going on TV being like, the sky is red, everyone. People would like wake up tomorrow morning, like, no, it's not, Joe. Like, what are you talking about?
Yeah. No, so, it's total gaslighting.
Yeah.
And, but the how well it works, I'm just shocked by it. Like, for example, like right after that, it was like 2 days after the Super Bowl, I'm in a couple of Bitcoin groups, you know, here in Canada. And there's an artist in Toronto who's started this campaign where he's created these t-shirts. Do you guys have the grocery store Loblaws?
We don't.
America? So it's a chain here. It'd be like Walmart or something.
Yeah.
But he's created these t-shirts that say Roblaws.
Oh my gosh.
And, you know, because basically the price of groceries is going so high. So someone in this, like this Bitcoin only group literally posted it saying, hey guys, because now Loblaws is trying to sue this guy because he's basically taken their logo and just changed the name on it.
Yeah.
They're trying to sue him. So someone in the Bitcoin group was like, hey, does anyone in the Bitcoin community know of any solutions, like sensor proof payment solutions that we could help this guy out with that he can continue to sell his t-shirts? And it was just like, me and one other guy were like, that's worse than Joe's Super Bowl commercial about inflation. Like, this has nothing to do with the grocery store. And this is something really important that people need to get their heads around, is that it's not the grocery store. It's not the mechanics. It's not the producers of the world. And when we start turning on each other like that, that's when shit gets bad.
Dude, absolutely. That's actually very discouraging to hear that. I'm sorry to hear that within a Bitcoin group, because it's people falling for the bait, man. It's like, the other thing Aristotle said about humans, we are the political animal.
Yeah.
So we are the rational animal, but we're also this political animal. And somehow you can short circuit people's rationality by pushing politics on them. And that's exactly what that sounds like to me.
Yeah.
It's like,
Well, and which makes me think that, like, is this an inside job? Like, cause here it is, like, here's this struggling artist who's like going, you know, kind of the David and Goliath story.
Yeah.
And they're like trying to paint it as this underdog.
Yeah.
So in my mind, it's stuff like that that's actually more dangerous than you know, Biden's probably, what, $10 million Super Bowl commercial.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I mean, what's 10 million bucks when you can print it out of thin air?
Exactly. Yeah.
This reminds me too of the old saying that the state is the great fiction by which one group of people try to live at the expense of another group of people. So that again, if you can get in that position of taking, well, then you will say and do whatever you can, right? You'll lie, you'll create entire ideologies, right?
Yeah.
Keynesian economics is an entire pseudoscientific ideology that just is intended to justify the government control of currency, basically. Marxism, right? From each according to their ability, to each according to their need. It's just this insane nonsense that's intended to say you own nothing and the state owns everything, right? It's just a very elaborate romantic lie that is a cover story for the world's greatest theft. And so that the because the state is engaged in systematic stealing, it constantly needs to engage in systematic deception to justify that stealing and sell it to its victims as if it's good for them, right? This is the whole inflation is good for the economy. This is the whole, oh, look at Joe wagging his finger at the free market, telling him to be better and not raise prices. Like, so the state basically wages war on human rationality in order to keep it politicized, keep people divided amongst themselves, and keep conflicts in the sphere of physical force, right? You don't want people resolving their disputes nonviolently and rationally, because if they do that, then there's no need for a state, right? The state is the monopoly on violence. You need people clashing in the physical space so the state can have some justification for its existence. And so we could go into this. I won't go into this now unless you would like to, but wokeism, right? This whole
Oh
what is a man, what is a woman? This is all an attack on definitions. This is all an attack on human rationality. Socrates said the beginning of wisdom is the definition of terms, right? If you cannot, if you and I cannot establish social consensus on basic terms, then we have an inability to communicate rationally. If we cannot communicate rationally, then things degenerate to physical conflict, right? This is the purpose of free speech, so that our ideas and thoughts can go to battle and die, so that our bodies do not have to. If the state can diffuse free speech, then it can force people into physical combat, and that is the domain where the state shines, by definition, as the monopoly on force.
Oh, it's super important, and I think, like, particularly folks in kind of my, my demographic, my community, which is, homesteaders, farmers, we tend to be quite, practical, just kind of hands-on people. And so we've kind of poo-pooed this idea that, like, that ideas matter, like the statement that you said before, like Marx is, from each according to their ability to each according to their needs, that idea has killed more people than probably
That's right.
any other
That's right.
idea. And it's an idea. So yeah, and I think, inflation as an idea, as a concept, is probably on par with, or actually it might even be more than that, because without inflation, Marx and all the communists would have had nothing to pay their soldiers with to go to war.
100%. This, by the way, just on Marxism, Marx's 1848 Manifesto to the Communist Party, plank number five, or measure number five, reads, a central state, an exclusive central state monopoly on cash and credit. The central bank is a Marxist institution. It is literally straight out of the playbook. So we have Marxist money everywhere in the world today. So anywhere that you may hear people espouse, oh, well, not here in the West, not here in the US, Canada, we're free market capitalists, blah, blah, blah. Well, let me ask you this. What's one half of every transaction? The answer is money. Well, guess what? Your money is socialist and/or Marxist, right? You don't have full private property rights in your money. Ask the Canadian truck protesters if they had full private property in their money. Ask the contributors to that protest if they had full private property rights in their money. This money can be instantly and arbitrarily seized, frozen, reversed. It's not private and it's not property, right? If it's not under the full control of the user, then it's not property. If it can be surveyed and tracked, then it's not private. So we don't have private property and money. Money is one half of every transaction. At best, any economy in the world that has a central bank is one half free market, one half Marxist.
Yeah. 100%, man. And so I think we've hammered down, you know, the problem that we're facing and the implications of you know, this fiat central bank monetary system, which, and we've been talking a lot about the, you know, the US's financial system, but it's the same everywhere in the world.
That's right.
And so let's dive into some solutions now, because, you know, if up until just a few, you know, years ago, this it would appear that there was no hope, but yep. Now there is a solution, and so I want to dig into that as this idea of how Bitcoin can be a solution in this regard. And I want to stress here, Bitcoin, not any other cryptocurrencies.
Yeah.
But by way of kind of working ourselves up to Bitcoin, I wanted to just quickly touch on some of the kind of base principles of, like, what's the function of money in a community? What are the limitations of things like barter? Why does something like money arise naturally in the evolution of a community?
Yeah, sure. So I think the best thing to read on this is Carl Menger's On the Origins of Money.
Okay.
And he basically describes that, you know, anywhere humans have cohabitated, there has been trade, right? That's, we've always traded with one another. And the emergence of money, very simply, is just whatever asset becomes most tradable within any community or any group of people. It really is that simple, right? That everything, when you have an economy, every asset has a trading pair against every other asset, but something is always going to be more tradable than other things, right? For instance, water, again, it's something that's very essential for life, that will tend to be accepted in trade by most people because, well, people need to drink water to survive. Mm-hmm. But a super niche product that most people, you know, might not be into. I always like the example of, you know, a green telescope. You know, but there's pretty niche. You know, there's probably not huge demand for green telescopes. So you're only a few people are going to trade whatever you have to offer for green telescopes. You get this liquidity stack, basically, where the assets like water, like food, things that are very universally demanded, they tend to be more tradable than things that are more niche, right? Like the green telescope. So as this liquidity stack sorts itself out within any trading economy, there is always, it's a stack, right? There's always something on top of the stack. There's some asset that is most tradable. That most tradable asset is money. It's just the universal medium of exchange, the most liquid asset in an economy. And it becomes, the reason it gets this designation medium of exchange is because once everyone identifies that this thing is tradable for basically everything else, or at least mostly everything else, then if I have green telescopes, the easiest way for me to get from green telescopes to chicken, if that's what I want, is to trade the green telescopes for money and then trade the money for chicken, because mm-hmm. money is the universally demanded asset.
Yeah.
So once that top asset becomes designated as like the most liquid thing, then everyone prefers to trade what they have for it, because once you have that, you can have anything else you want. It's the least hops, mm-hmm. right? The least number of trades from what you have to what you want. So money serves that purpose in any trading economy. And notice this description of how money emerges is independent of the state or government. This has nothing to do with the state. Gold has been money long before there has been a state. People have been trading long before there has been a state. So that's very important, because most, I think, when you go onto the streets today and you poll the audience and you say, what is money? Most people will say something about government paper, right? They'll say, oh, it's this little sheet of paper in my pocket, or this account online that the government approves this thing. You know, they think the government is somehow an inherent participant in money, and this is simply not the case. Government has just monopolized money. They've imposed a control structure on top of a free market phenomenon. And so that's, again, Menger's description of how money emerges. And now the pathway by which it emerges tends to go, this is going to be from economist William Jevons, who described the emergence of gold. He said that it goes through these different phases, and at each phase, the money basically serves a different function. So when it came to gold, initially people just collected it as, you know, it's shiny, right? It's got a yellow metallic brilliance. You can adorn yourself with it. It's very malleable, so you can shape it and to make jewelry pretty easily. Relatively indestructible, so it's very long lasting. So initially people just used gold as a collectible effectively. But as it turns out, gold is also very rare. So as people started to collect it, that created a source of demand for gold. And then over time, as other goods and services increased in quantity relative to gold, because gold is so rare, the purchasing power of gold goes up, right? Because it's harder to obtain gold than it is chickens or water or food, right? Especially as these economies become more advanced, more sophisticated. Mm-hmm. So over time, gold shifts from being a collectible into being what's called a store of value, something that you can hold excess economic energy in, right? Savings, you know, like a savings account, basically. That's what the store value function is. And then eventually, as gold starts to store enough value, people eventually, it becomes that most tradable asset, right? It's got so much value in it, people will trade it for anything else, right? So it actually rises to the top of that liquidity stack and becomes a medium of exchange. People will use gold to denominate their transactions in, right? So gold actually becomes money at that point when it becomes a medium of exchange by most definitions. And then finally, when gold is being traded widely enough and most enough people accept it, eventually people start to communicate in terms of gold. You will price things in terms of gold. And indeed, most modern currencies, right? The dollar, the lira, the pound, the reason they have all of these names of the currency, they're based in weighting metrics, right? Like the pound is an obvious one. The lira is another one. Even dollar has something to do with weight. It's because the paper certificate represented a specific weight of the monetary metal. That's mm-hmm. what it was.
It was a receipt.
Exactly. So people, after the money is being used widely enough as a medium of exchange, people will eventually start to talk about prices in terms of the money. Mm-hmm. They'll negotiate in terms of the money. They'll perform economic calculation in their own mind and their own businesses between other parties in terms of the money. And they will execute trades in terms of the money. So it becomes the de facto unit of account and accountancy and accounting.
Yeah.
Right. This is where money becomes linguistic, right? You actually develop a pricing system based on the money itself. And the pricing system is extremely important for the global economy. This is what coordinates, as we talked about apples earlier, right? It's, you don't need to know about the drought. You don't need to know anything about it. You just need to know the price of apples went up. And as a producer, I know I should produce more because it'll make me richer. As a consumer, I know I should consume less because that'll keep me richer, right? So it's this very powerful means of data compression that you don't need to hear anyone's story. It's compressing all the stories in the world into one number that everyone can act upon with a high degree of certainty. And so the pricing system is responsible for coordinating more human action than I think any other economic signal, any other signal in the world, right? As we say, talk is cheap.
Right?
You can say a lot of things, but when you put your money where your mouth is, all of a sudden, that's a much higher signal message, right? So the pricing system is this high signal messaging system that coordinates human action at scale. And all of this is facilitated through money. But to answer your question, those are the three functions. Money needs to store value, which means it needs to hold its purchasing power across time, at least maintain it, ideally go up, right? If the economy is becoming more productive and I'm holding a share of money, well, then I would want to participate in that economy's growth. right? And this is what gold's done, right? Is the old saying here is, an ounce of gold has been enough money to purchase a fine man's suit for like over a century, right? Yeah. So number, like fine suits in terms of gold, the price has basically remained flat. Now, if you price a fine man's suit in terms of dollars over the past 100 years, it's probably gone from $40 to 4,000. You know, it's done a 100x. Mm-hmm. So that's the store of value, something that holds its purchasing power or slightly participates in the economic growth as the economy becomes more advanced. The medium of exchange is that, again, the top of the liquidity stack that people can trade into and out of this thing very seamlessly, so they can have the least number of jumps from what they have to what they want. And then the final function that money provides is that unit of account, that we can actually think in terms of dollars. We can talk in terms of dollars. We can look at our net worth in terms of dollars, right? And we can compare these things to each other, other businesses, other assets, et cetera.
Yeah. Just as you're talking there, it hit me that like those three, like without money, in, even no matter what size community you're in, you'd have, you'd basically be like deaf, dumb, and blind because you wouldn't be able to communicate. Yep. And as a result of that lack of communication, there'd be no exchange and there'd be no way to store for tomorrow. So you'd yes. basically just be living day to day. And I think we touched on this, you know, in our first meeting, which is like without money, there is no civilization.
That's right.
Period.
Yes. Bingo. Yeah. There's a great quote you just reminded me of. Money is like a sixth sense without which you cannot make a complete use of the other five.
Yeah.
It is. Yeah. It's not an analogy or an exaggeration to yeah. say that we're actually interconnecting our minds through money, right? Just through yeah. the pricing system. It's where many minds become one in the pricing system, yeah. just like we do with language, by the way, right? Like if someone writes an incredible book and we all read the book, right? A lot of people, Atlas Shrugged, for instance, I don't know who's read that one, but
oh yeah,
there's a whole society built around that book, right? There's literally multiple foundations and groups of people that have come together under the set of ideas contained in that book. And mm-hmm. they've become, you know, they've connected their minds and their bodies together through the book. The pricing system is doing the same thing. It's just a different type of information. You're getting this economic information about how much sacrifice is necessary to produce a thing, right? And that's coordinating everyone around it, the producers and the yeah. consumers. So yeah, it is indispensable to civilization, to say the least.
Yeah, it's huge. And I think this is why, like, as you know, you say so much that the question, what is money, is just so important. And I think so many people, including myself, take it for granted. But when you really start digging into it, like it, this is a profound, you know, life altering, society altering concept that we all need to wrap our heads around.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah. Okay. So I think now we can dive into, you know, some examples of money and where we can touch on, you know, the limitations of barter and cash and precious metals, even other cryptocurrencies. And then of course, you know, Bitcoin through the lens of, one of the things one of your favorite concepts I've come across is you talk about the five properties that a money must have in order to achieve those functions of store of value, medium of exchange, and unit of account. And those five are that money must be durable, must be divisible, it must be scarce, it must be portable, and it must be recognizable. So could you kind of, yeah, give some examples and talk about some of the other types of money that have been used, where they fall short, and start to bring in the brilliance of Bitcoin and why it just knocks those five out of the park.
Yeah. So this is, I think, one of the most important answers to the question, what is money? Because you're actually looking at the services that money renders to a user. Now we call this the properties of money, right? If I'm going to describe a rock to you, right? I'm going to describe the properties of the rock to you, right? It's hard, it's jagged, it's gray, it's dense, you know, yeah. like it makes a loud sound when I drop it, right? I'm describing how I interface with the thing, like what it does. If I throw it at a window, it breaks the window, right? That's a service the rock can basically render to me because I can't do that without the rock. Mm-hmm. And when you look at economic demand, like what people really want, it's all about services. It's not actually about the physical thing. And this is a little bit counterintuitive, but the example I like to use here is a car, right? Like I own a nice F-350 turbo diesel custom built tank beast. Like I joke that if Batman had a truck, it would look like my truck, you know, and it's fantastic. It's physically an amazing thing. I think it looks great, et cetera.
Yeah.
But I don't actually want the truck, right? I want to be able to go from A to B in a large machine that gets good gas mileage for what it is, a machine that can tow anything in the world, a machine that's got a 12,000 pound winch on the front of it so I can pull the truck out of something if it gets stuck. There's a status symbol element to it, right? To drive a big truck is like a social status thing. So it's all of these services that are associated with the good. Those are the things that I actually want. It's never actually about the good. So when it comes to money, again, it's not the actual money. It's what services is this thing rendering to me as a user? And the reason this is such an important question is because it gives you a strong indication of what people will choose as money, right? And again, this applies to any technology. You could have seen something like the smartphone becoming dominant if you thought in these terms, right? If you just compared, okay, the landline, what do people want when they communicate with a phone, right? They want freedom of communication, to be able to access one another at any time, any place, and communicate, okay? Well, the landline is stuck, right? It's stuck to a wall somewhere. So you give up a lot of freedom. You can't move around that much. If you compare that to a cell phone, well, the cell phone's mobile. It can move around anywhere. So in terms of the properties people want from a communication system, the mobile phone is clearly superior to the land phone because you can be anywhere and communicate from anywhere. So just thinking through that lens on things, it becomes more obvious what technology will become dominant.
Mm-hmm.
So when you look at money, and before I go into these, actually, I'm not going to go into the properties. I'm just going to mention where there's some failings.
Yeah.
So, but I'll give a definition first that I think is useful and a framing for this. Another really good answer. So in addition to these five properties, which is a great answer for money, there's another answer I think that's very important. Money is a tool for moving economic value across space and time.
Yeah.
Right? Gold is fantastic for moving economic value across time.
Yeah.
Right. As we said earlier, it's something that holds its purchasing power. It has a relatively scarce supply so that as the output of goods and services in the world goes up, but the supply of gold goes up more slowly, that gold becomes more precious and therefore has more purchasing power. It lays claim to more goods and services. However, gold is not so great at moving economic value across space. It's not bad, right? We can fashion it into coins and bars, and we can move it about with some degree of risk. You know, like you have to keep it secure and people can take it from you. You can bury it in your backyard, but that's kind of a hassle. You got to, you know, dig it up and bury it. And if someone finds it with a metal detector, then you're screwed. So what did we do with gold? Because it wasn't so good at moving value across space, is like, well, we figured out if we just put it all in one place called a bank, and the bank gives us a redemption certificate for that gold called a bank note, then we can just trade this paper as if it's as good as gold. And it is as good as gold, so long as the bank keeps its promise to keep the gold in reserve and to not overissue the paper, which is another issue. Yeah. So that works, right? We had a great money for moving value across time and gold, but not space. But we augmented its ability to move value across space by introducing the gold-backed currency. And a gold-backed currency functions really well as money, right? You have, again, the scarcity property of gold, giving it the store value across time, the scarcity and the durability. And you've augmented the portability so that you have the ability to move economic value across space in transacting with others. Now, the problem, of course, with a gold-backed currency is that you've introduced the man in the middle. You now have to trust the middleman, who is the banker, to not either abscond with the gold, or what's more common, to run what's called a fractional reserve. So if he has 10 kilograms of gold on deposit in his safe, and he's issued 10 kilograms worth of redemption certificates, worth of banknotes, that's a full reserve bank, right? His assets match his liabilities. Assets are gold in vault. Liabilities are these banknotes that he has circulating with his customers. They can come and redeem. They have a on-demand liability with the bank, right? The bank has to honor that token when they say, hey, here's my 1 kilogram worth of banknotes. Give me the gold. Give me the metal. The bank has to be able to honor that. So when they have 10 kilos in the vault and 10 kilos in liabilities or banknotes circulating, assets match liabilities. It's a solvent business.
Mm-hmm.
However, the incentive to just increase, to just add more paper into circulation is gigantic. Because not only can you lend this paper at interest, you can also spend this paper at full value. As we said earlier, when those who receive the newly printed money first, you're basically giving yourself the newly printed money first if you just issue this additional liability. And then so long as none of your customers, or so long as a sufficient proportion of your customers don't come to redeem it all at once, you can get away with it,
Yeah. Basically.
So say you just overissue 10%, right? You've got 10 kilograms in the vault and you've issued 11 kilograms worth of banknotes. So long as 90% of your customers don't come in on the same day and try to redeem the gold, then you're good, right? You can keep the scam going. Now, if you issue 50% more, well, then only 50% of your customers can come in any one day, and then the fraud is exposed. This is a bank run, by the way. Anyone who's ever seen the movie A Wonderful Life, a bank run is only possible when a bank is fractionally reserved, when it's running a fraud in this way. If it's a full reserve bank and you've got 10 in the vault and 10 circulating and 100% of your customers come to redeem, you're fine, right? You've got all your liabilities matched to assets, so you're good. So this is the problem, basically, is like you can't trust people to custody other people's money. You introduce what's called an agency problem, and that's when an individual is supposed to act in your best interest, but it is in their best interest to act against your best interest. People being self-interested, political animals, you could maybe even argue rational animals in this way, like short-term rational, they will decide to do what is in their individual best interest, even at the expense of their long run, the long run not being in their best interest effectively. And so this gives way to the scam that is fractional reserve banking. And basically that's what we've had, right? Gold was the best tool. It was the most, to sort of sum up the history of monetary competition, you could say we've tried a lot of things across time.
Yeah.
It was eventually determined through this long sequence of experimentation that monetary metals were the most durable, divisible, recognizable, and portable forms of money we had in the world. And of all the monetary metals, gold exhibited the greatest scarcity, which means the most inflexible supply, right? It's the hardest commodity to debase. And that's why gold became money. But because gold lacked in terms of portability, we needed to centralize its custody in a bank and issue a gold-backed currency on top of it. That introduced this man in the middle problem, this agency problem. And that is what gives rise to fractional reserve banking, which is a scam that tends to get run until it breaks. And then you get into zero reserve banking, which is fiat currency. Fiat currency is just money because the government says so.
Yeah.
Like you'll use this money or else we'll hurt you.
Yeah.
And so that is, and I'm obviously glossing over a lot here, but that's been basically the sequence when evaluated through the lens of the properties of money. And it's obvious, you know, again, we called these services earlier. It's pretty obvious, right? You want a money that's durable. Well, you don't want your money to rot. You put money in a safe. If you used oranges as money and it just rotted in the safe, that's not very useful. Okay. So that's not a good service. I want a metal, something that holds its character over time.
Yeah.
It needs to be divisible so that I can transact at different scales, right? I want to be able to buy coffee as easily as I can buy a house. It needs to be portable so I can move it across space, right? That was the shortcoming of gold. That's why we needed currency. It needs to be recognizable, which means parties to a transaction need to be able to tell it is what you say it is, right? We've heard the term, probably heard the term sound money. This actually relates to what a gold coin sounded like when dropped from a certain height. It had a certain resonance, and that was a heuristic used to determine its authenticity. They also used to do what's called assaying gold, so they'd actually test it, doing different chemical techniques and whatnot to measure the authenticity of the gold. This was all to make sure it wasn't counterfeit, basically. And then finally, you want a money that's scarce, which basically holds its purchasing power across time. Now, just as one last button on this, and I'll throw it back over to you. This is why, like, that whole framing explains perfectly to me why Bitcoin is such a profound innovation.
Yeah.
Okay. Money is a tool for moving value across time and space. The money that best moves value across time, ideally, it's a money with the least flexible supply, which means the least subject to change. The ideal money then would have a totally inflexible supply. It would not be subject to change whatsoever. So that if I hold 1,000 of this unit of currency and there's only a possible 21 million, I hold a guaranteed fraction of the total money supply forever. No one can ever increase the money supply and debase me or confiscate wealth from me. So I hold a guaranteed fraction of that total money supply, right? 1,000 out of a possible 21 million units. As the quantity of goods and services goes up in the world, my fraction of the money supply appreciates. Whereas with any, like, if even if it were gold, as the purchasing power of the gold goes up, you're incentivizing more miners to mine, to bring more supply online and to debase other holders of gold. This is true with any commodity, and this is why commodities are ultimately inferior, imperfect forms of money.
Yeah.
An ideal money would have a fixed supply.
Yeah.
What is Bitcoin? Bitcoin is the first fixed supply asset in the history of the human race. I think it's the only one we can ever create as well, for reasons I won't get into now, but it basically has a fixed supply of 21 million, cannot be altered under any conceivable circumstances. Okay. Perfects the transmission of economic value across time. What about space, right? Gold is really good at time, not space. Well, Bitcoin is purely digital, right? It's just information. To hold Bitcoin, you know, quote unquote, hold Bitcoin is to possess a private key, which is you could think of this as like the password, effectively, to be able to move funds. Well, you can move information at the speed of light with telecommunications. So I can't imagine being able to move your money across space much more quickly than that. And you can also move it across space without any intermediaries, right? This doesn't need to go through a bank. This doesn't need to go through a financial institution. You can literally send this from person to person. So it's like sliding a gold bag of gold coins across the table, but you can transmit it over the telephone lines.
Yeah.
So it's a truly radical innovation that we've perfected, or nearly perfected, this tool that we can transmit economic value perfectly across time because we have a fixed money supply, and perfectly across space because it's a fully dematerialized informational money. And I'll pause there. There's a lot of other mind-bending things about Bitcoin, but I think that's a pretty useful framing.
Yeah, that's fantastic, man. So you've done a fantastic podcast with Preston Pysh where you go into kind of debunking, you know, misconceptions about Bitcoin and some of the things just that are, you know, various detractors say about it. So I don't want to go into that here. I'm going to link that in the show notes. Mm-hmm. But could you say just a few words to differentiate, like, Bitcoin, not crypto? Like, why not Ethereum or Dogecoin or any of these other, the thousands of as they're known locally in the Bitcoin community, shitcoins? Why not them?
Yeah, so the key action word here is decentralization. The Bitcoin maximalist viewpoint is that Bitcoin is the only decentralized crypto asset, which means that it is a neutral protocol. There's no individual or group that has any disproportionate influence on its development path, on its money supply, on its rules, etc. And you could analogize this, maybe more than an analogy, really. The internet itself is a stack of these open source protocols. So you've probably heard of HTTP or TCP/IP or SMTP. These are just pieces of software that are open source, so anyone can inspect, modify, change these things. Yet through this free market process of experimentation, the world has basically standardized onto a few of these things, like HTTP, like TCP/IP, et cetera. And these become the standard, basically, right? They become ossified and standardized as the protocol that everyone uses. You could think of this as like a language in a way. It's like the language everyone speaks. So if you want to interact with other websites today, well, you're going to use the HTTP protocol because that's the one that has all the network effects. That's the one all the other websites are using. And so the internet has sort of evolved organically as a stack of these open source protocols. And it's useful to think of Bitcoin as just the latest evolution in that stack, that instead of Bitcoin being an open source protocol for moving information in a way that doesn't require permission, right? It's just someone using software. We can now move actual economic value on the internet without asking permission, right? We could just literally move money peer to peer, as I described earlier. And so that's, I think, really important to understand, that Bitcoin is much more like the internet, whereas all of these other shit coins, as you said, are much more like companies, right? You could say these are, generously, you would say they're liquid venture capital subjected to little, if any, due diligence, meaning they're like startup companies with their own token. But it's so, the bar to start one, it takes 15 minutes on Ethereum to launch your own shitcoin. So yeah, there's literally tens of thousands of these things, right? The bar is so low, there's so little, people aren't actually looking into it. And then the opportunity to scam people is so high. Because if you can just convince someone that, oh, this token does A, B, and C, and they don't get it, because obviously there's a huge information asymmetry in the space.
Yeah.
People don't understand, you know, half of the words we're talking about here, you know, decentralization included, that scammers can take advantage of that and conduct what we call innovation theater, right? They can pretend like they're building something really fancy and cool, get you to buy this token, and then they do what's called a rug pull, where they just sell the token, right? You've bought it at a higher and higher price, and they dump it all, and they, you know, leave the investor or customer holding the bag, basically. So less generously, we would say that most of these shit coins are outright scams.
Yeah.
And I think if you study a little bit of the history, you know, since shit coins came online in like 2014 timeframe, over 90% of these things have been outright scams.
Yeah.
None of them have outperformed Bitcoin over any meaningful timeframe. Like, yeah,
not even close.
Yeah. And most of them don't last, right? Most of them don't last, you know, more than 4 years. So that would be the key difference, is that, you know, Bitcoin is more like the internet and shitcoins are more like startup companies, but with a heavy tendency towards being a scam.
Yeah.
So as we say in Bitcoin, well, there's a number of mantras we use. Not your keys, not your coin. If you don't hold your private key, you don't hold your Bitcoin. You hold, you know, if you have Bitcoin on Coinbase, for instance, you have an IOU to Bitcoin. You don't have real Bitcoin. Mm-hmm. Very common misconception for people. And we also say Bitcoin, not shitcoin, because all of these other shitcoins just don't hold a candle to Bitcoin. And even if they succeeded in their market use cases that a lot of them put out, say if all of the tens of thousands succeeded, I don't think it would still equal even a fifth of Bitcoin's total addressable market, right? Bitcoin's competing to be global money.
Yeah.
All the other use cases combined for these shitcoins would be less than 20% of Bitcoin's total addressable market. And that assumes that they're all successful. That assumes that they overcome all of these technical challenges. And Bitcoin doesn't need to do any of that. It just needs to do what it's been doing perfectly for the past 15 years. So on a risk reward basis, Bitcoin is just the obvious choice.
Yeah, fantastic. So Robert, you've been doing your podcast for over 3 years now. You've got over 420 episodes. What has changed in your life for the better now that you know more about what money actually is?
I don't know if this is, it's hard to say whether it's, I mean, I guess it's a product of knowledge and a product of having Bitcoin as a tool. But this is pretty common with a lot of people. You tend to start saving a lot more once you start interacting with Bitcoin because, well, guess what? You've got a tool that works, right?
Yeah.
Unless you were burying gold in your backyard or collecting physical gold, that worked pretty decent as savings, but it's pretty impractical, right? If you move house or you want to spend some of it, or, you know, it's just tricky to secure. A lot of people aren't going to play that game of let me dig a hole in my backyard and bury gold or put gold in a safe. It's just less useful, less practical for people. But Bitcoin gives you that same effect, but and it's something that's very practical, very easy to use. So once you start engaging with Bitcoin, most people tend to become great savers, frankly. And I've always saved. I've always been a little bit on the conservative side. You know, I have like a finance and accounting background, so I've always saved money. But Bitcoin has definitely thrown gas on that fire. Like, you really cannot get enough sats. And the purchasing power goes up or has gone up tremendously over 4-year periods historically. And there's a strange thing about this too. Now, if you read the book, The Bitcoin Standard, you would learn about this concept called time preference. And time preference basically means, it's a little bit counterintuitive for people, but the lower your time preference, the less concerned you are with immediate satisfaction. You basically have a longer time horizon, right? Lower time preference equals a longer time horizon. And you start to become more interested in timeless things. Like, you, a lot of this is also common among Bitcoiners. A lot of Bitcoiners stop drinking, they start working out, they start settling down, they start making families, they start going to church. Like, all of these traditional values seem to come back into people's lives. And it's, I mean, it sounds like a jump. You're like, what do you mean? You had a good savings technology, so you found God? Like, what are you talking about? But I don't know, like, the proof's in the pudding, right? You can go spend some time with Bitcoiners and you'll see it happening. And this is at a time, by the way, when all of these trends are going the opposite direction in the rest of the world, right? People are going to church less, getting married less, having less children, less life satisfaction, blah, 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 blah. But in the Bitcoin world, it's the opposite. I don't know exactly why. I mean, I guess you could attribute it to lowering time preference. I have definitely experienced that. It's hard for me to disentangle whether that's, you know, my studying, my podcast journey. Like, that itself could be considered an expression of lower time preference too. Like, I've always been someone interested in reading. I've always been someone that likes to exercise, for instance. But since getting into Bitcoin, I'm doing it more than ever. Like, I've given up drinking. I work out more than ever. I'm more disciplined about that. I'm more disciplined about my health. I'm more disciplined about my diet. I'm more disciplined about my reading, my writing, etc. So I don't know. I think it just all around makes you a better person. And if it were just me, then I would think maybe this sounds totally crazy. But when I go to these conferences and I spend time with Bitcoiners, I'm surrounded by people experiencing the same thing. Like, obviously not all the same, but everyone has kind of the same flavor. It's like, you know, I'm a person. I had some good things about me and some bad things about me. I got into Bitcoin. I learned a lot of new things and had to unlearn a lot of other things. And on net, I've become a better person. You know, I've stopped doing the bad. I'm doing less of the bad things and more of the good things.
Yeah,
pretty much. And that's, I don't know. It's mind blowing. It's really, really cool. sounds maybe too good to be true, but I would challenge you to go to some of these Bitcoin events and engage with Bitcoin yourself and see if it works for you too.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, so if you could go back in time, you know, just before you started this journey, which I you were about 19, you said when you first read The Creature from Jekyll Island.
Yeah, that's right.
And you had, you know, like 30 seconds to tell yourself something before you got sucked back into the wormhole. What would you tell yourself, you know, whether it was a warning or what would you say to yourself before you got brought back?
Oh my goodness. Okay, so buy Bitcoin. That's an easy one, right? Because then I would have probably bought Bitcoin in 2010, and you know, everyone wishes they got it earlier. Let's just put it that way.
Yeah.
I would also say I've gone through, like, the reason I'm wearing this ridiculous outfit today is because of an EMF protective gear, basically. Mm-hmm. And I have Wi-Fi in my office. It's getting removed tomorrow, but said we would do this podcast today, so we're doing it today. So I dressed up looking like a Jedi. This is because I've been on a long health journey, actually. Like, I've gone through some digestive issues, and I've had to learn, like, it's this whole puzzle of, like, how to eat, what not to eat as you get older. It's been a real challenging cognitive journey, like, frustrating, right? You think you figure one thing out. It's like trying to plug the dam. You know, you plug two holes and another leak spouts over here, and it's just been a whole puzzle.
Yeah.
So I think I would tell myself to look into keto carnivore diet. You know, take your health seriously. In my 20s, I just burned the candle at both ends. I worked hard, played hard. You know, didn't bother me in my 20s, but caught up to me in my 30s. So I could probably save myself a lot of heartache if I could transmit a message backwards to myself about that. And I would also say start having kids sooner. And like, that is the meaning of life, as far as I can tell, is making a family. And I've come to this point. I don't know if this is the product of my age or Bitcoin or what, but the only thing I want to do in life anymore is make some beautiful people and build some valuable businesses.
Like, yeah.
I don't really know what else to do. You know, it's people helping people, basically. It's kind of like the meaning of life is my mantra there. Cause you know, obviously being a parent, you're helping people become people, and then building valuable businesses, you're helping people solve problems. So those are the messages I would send back to myself.
Yeah. Robert, I think that's a beautiful place to end. Thank you so much for your time today. Thank you so much for just the work that you've done building up, you know, the What Is Money show, and I don't know, you've probably got 1,000 hours into podcast episodes alone. Is there anything that you'd like to, you know, leave listeners with before we sign off?
No, I mean, thank you, Dakota, for having me. This has been a really fun conversation. I'm glad you've gotten some value out of it. And yeah, we're, I don't know, over 420 something episodes. So I don't know. We're probably pushing that 1,000 hour mark.
Yeah.
And it's just, yeah, I'm very grateful. Like, I'm a nerd at heart, if it's not obvious, and I get to nerd out for a living. So I'm very grateful that I get to do what I love and help people in the process. So feel very, very grateful about that. I would just point people to the podcast website, whatismoneypodcast.com. And then my biggest social media platform is Twitter, or X now. And you can find me at Breedlove22, BREEDLOVE22.
Awesome. Thanks so much, man. Take care.
Thanks, man.
I hope you gained some actionable insights from this podcast about how you can fight the powers that shouldn't be by building your own homestead. If you did, please take the time to share this episode and click all those buttons to like, rate, and follow. This helps spread our message, it makes sure that you never miss an episode, and it sends a middle finger to globalists like Klaus Schwab. I also suggest that you sign up to my newsletters directly on my websites that are in the show notes. With the Government of Canada recently passing Bill C-11, the Online Streaming Act, the threat of me being censored or removed from mainstream media platforms like this one is becoming a reality. If that time ever comes, we can stay connected. Thanks again for listening, and take care until next time.